Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. This is Literary Viewpoints, and this is going to be absolutely fantastic, I can tell you now. First of all, let me thank the sun god for bringing the sun back and no more rain and thunderstorms. It's beautiful outside. I don't know how it is about you, but up in Westchester, it's gorgeous. So, 20 years after the unsolved case of Stacy Walker's disappearance, when called police detective Hank Madden is convicted to find her body and track down her missing husband, her presumed murderer. 4 months later, editor Max Freeman's client Candace Epson is pushed in front of a car near Central Park. As he digs into her background to declare his name, Freeman grows suspicious of Candace's connection to Farias Institute for Lucid Dreaming on the Upper East Side. And for those of you that never really, it could really happen to you. We have the author of Lucidity here, David Conway. Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. So could you tell me what made you decide to write a book about lucid dreaming, and what kind of research did you have to do in order to focus on this topic?
You know, I've been thinking about it for a while. I wanted to be a theme of my second book, but I couldn't get in there. I've done three books. So the first one was Night Music, second one was The Big Exit, and they took place in Silicon Valley, and I couldn't get that theme in. But for the third one, I was determined to get it, to have it run through. And you know, I think I'd had some lucid dreams myself, and on top of that, I did a lot of I talked to some people who had dealt with some of these. There's some institutes out there, Lucid Dreaming Institute. I named mine the Lucid Dreaming Center. And then on top of it, I read several books on lucid dreaming. So that was the basis of my research. And it's a little bit of an area where there's a lot of, there's supplements out there. My day job, I'm an executive editor at CNET.com, which is a big tech website, and we actually have had stuff sent to us that's supposed to, things that you put on your head to stimulate lucid dreaming and stuff like that. So there was this kind of tech element to it as well.
That's interesting. So you have two main characters here that are so different. You have Madden and Freeman. Why did you decide to connect them? How would you describe these two? Because they're interesting, and I truly hope you're going to bring them back again together.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I wrote my first novel, Night Music, with Matt, Detective Hank Madden, and he was already a little bit older in the first novel, and I wrote it as a standalone mystery thriller, and I didn't necessarily expect to have to bring him back. And so he then has progressively gotten older, and he's retired at the end of the Big Exit. He actually retired, so he's retired in this one. He's now a private investigator, but I grew up in Palo Alto, Menlo Park, California, where actually the book is based, and I had the first two books I had done that were mostly based there, and I'd hung out with some people from the Menlo Park Police, and in interviewing a retired detective for the police department there, I came across he described this real life case that he'd worked on for many years, where where a woman had gone missing, and the husband, they thought the husband had done it, but then he ended up fleeing the country, and it took them about 15 years to actually bring him to justice. So it was inspired. At least the plot line from the California side of this novel was inspired by that true life case. The guy that did it, his name was Morrow, M-O-R-R-O-W. But by the same token, I live in New York, so I wanted to finally set the novel at least partially in New York. So I created this New York character. So that's how, and in my books, the detective isn't necessarily the protagonist. I always have a different protagonist in each of the books, and really it's Madden and a few other characters that have continued on. I basically create a whole new protagonist for each book.
Well, he's an interesting one. He's serious. I like him. He's got a book and he doesn't give up. That's what I like about him. So we've got Stacy, who's gone missing, and Manon is hired to find her and her husband, Ross. So why would he accept so much money from someone by the name of Shelby, and what was Shelby's motive in asking him to find her?
Well, Shelby's this, you know, a Silicon Valley entrepreneur who has sold his company, so he's, you know, worth about $500 million. He's not quite a billionaire. But he has a ton of money. And he himself, as a teenager, had actually, he worked in the Police Explorers, which is kind of, you know, an internship for kids who want to be part of the police. And that's a true thing. And he had worked trying to find her body. And that was inspired by one of the police officers in the Menlo Park. The police department told me about how he had gone around as a teenager trying to find the same, in this case, the Morrow case, of trying to find the body and seeing if they were basically looking for her up in the hills of Los Gatos and in the Bay Area, and where they thought the husband had buried her. So it was inspired by. So in the book, this guy's an entrepreneur, not a police officer, and he's got a lot of money. And this case, this murder, has always sort of haunted him in the sense that, you know, as a young man, he'd been trying to find her body through the Police Explorers unit. And then and later on in life, he felt that if you could throw enough money at a missing persons case or a unsolved, you know, a cold case, that you could actually, if we in this country threw enough money at these things, we could actually solve these crimes. So it's part of his Silicon Valley mentality that if you, you know, are entrepreneurial and invest in these things, that he that you can solve a case. And so he brings on Madden, who was, you know, retired. He's worked on a couple of high profile cases in the area, so he's well known. And he offers him all this money, and by the same token, there's a bit of a nefarious side to this, the entrepreneur, mm-hmm. who you don't know, you know, what exactly his motives are. He's a little crazy. He likes playing around with people, and he's, you know, so that's his character.
Well, that would be Frank Marcus, and he is crazy. So what
that's
significance
Yeah, he's the one thing about the book is the guy Max Schremer out in New York is a book doctor, kind of a book doctor anyway. There's all these I have some familiarity with self-published books. My first book was initially self-published and then picked up by a traditional publisher, Knife Music. So I've written an article on CNET called 25 Things You Need to Know About Self-Publishing. I've gotten over the years, I've had a lot of people ask me to sort of edit books for them, tell them how to get things published and things like that. So the Max Schremer character was based on a guy who was, if I had actually taken all these people up on their offers to help produce their books, that would sort of be Max Schremer. He's a little shady, but he's got a good heart. And so everyone, if you read it closely, almost everyone in the book either has written a book or wants to write a book. And so the guy, Frank Marcus, who was a friend of Stacy Walker's, actually ended up writing a book about her disappearance. He had been a bartender, and then he married someone who had a real estate company, and a small boutique real estate company in Silicon Valley, and he's ended up making a lot of money in real estate, the real estate boom out there. But, you know, years earlier, he wrote this book, and so Madden goes to him when he has to investigate the cold case. And that's how the two of them ended up joining up, because Matt's looking for his perspective on the case. The two are, they're a bit adversarial.
Why does Madden decide to accept all this money? For what reason? He has another reason besides just to find her. Why does he accept all that money? What is his main reason? There's an underlying reason there.
It's partially. He's not really doing much. He himself is trying to write a book, and has a little bit of. He's having trouble. People have told him his story is great. He had been sexually abused as a younger boy, and there's a lot of the stuff had already come out in my first two novels, and everyone says you got to write a book, you got to write your autobiography, and he can't really do it, so he's just hanging. He's actually working at a hardware store, a friend of his hardware store, Ace Hardware, mm-hmm. part time, and he also has it's not so much for the money that he's accepting it, but because in California, in Menlo Park anyway, he'd already been on the force for 30 years, and when you retire as a police officer in California, you get most of your pay for the rest of your life. He was making a good salary. That law has changed now, so the newer police officers don't get that. He also has years earlier he married a Nicaraguan woman, and she has a family back in Nicaragua, so she's always sending money back to her family. And he takes part of the money that he gets as an advance from the entrepreneur Shelby. He's making about $20,000. Shelby offers to give him, I think, $20,000 a month to investigate the case. So he gives her some money to send to her relatives. So he's kind of a hero in her eyes for doing that. And then he also brings in a lawyer friend who's appeared in some of the books, and he's put her on a retainer. So part of the money is going to other people too initially. So
that's interesting. So we have Freema, and then somebody pushes Candace in front of a car. And why do they want the money that Candace? Well, there's Victor Braden, and why does he threaten him? So what do these characters have in common, and why did he want the money that Candace would get from her novels, this guy, and what happened to her, and who did they say pushed her in front of a moving car?
Well, I'll tell you I can tell you how that's the New York side of the story, and I always felt, I walk around the streets of New York sometimes, and you see these homeless guys, and so one day it occurred to me, well, what if someone wanted to make it look like a homeless person committed a crime? They could, what if a homeless person pushed someone in front of, in New York City, there's always the fear of someone pushing you in front of the subway when you're on the subway platform. In this case, just pushing you out in the street in front of a car. And if a homeless person did it, what if there's some question of whether the homeless person did it or not? So that's how that sort of that side of the story came about, that kind of what if. And from there, once she's pushed in front of the car, Max Fremers, she writes these on the side. She writes these erotic fiction novels under a pen name, Lexi Hart. And so they're actually pretty successful, these self-published novels. And Max Fremer has helped her put these out on Amazon. And So, but she owes him some money. And so that he ends up being called in by the police because he's been texting her the night before she's pushed in front of the car. He's been threatening her in the sense of saying, you know, you really have to pay me this money. And it turns out other people, I don't want to give away any of the spoilers, but basically there are other people that have a stake in her demise, including the people at the lucid dreaming center, and this guy, Victor Braden, who has part of his arm missing. And that has a tie into the case in California.
Yeah, that I know. That was interesting. But the Lucid Dream Center, how did you create that? We have a few more questions before, but how did you create the Lucid Dream Center and that FEMA has, and how did you create that? How did you create the lucid dreams that these people have? That was interesting. Because for those of you out there that don't think it really happens, you really can have a lucid dream. I've been there, done it, know it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, there's a whole, I wouldn't say cult, but a movement out there that just like any of, in California, there was a Lucid Dreaming Institute. There's a guy at Stanford who had run that group. And as I said, there's a lot of people who are trying. There's a lot of people have lucid dreams just by chance, but there are groups of people out there. It's not, you know, it's mostly around the country, online forums, all that stuff. There's huge talk about how to actually try to have lucid dreams and have them on a regular basis. And there's, you know, with sleep patterns, and there's really certain times. Mm. Certain times of the night you can have them. Oftentimes it's in the morning. Everyone's a little bit different. Everyone's brain chemistry is a little bit different. So the idea, of course, is, you know, there's all this talk of virtual reality now, and you put on a headset and you see this three-dimensional world. Well, in fact, our brains are the greatest virtual reality there is. And so if you were able to harness that and be able to say, okay, I want to now have a virtual reality experience where I control it myself through my own brain, wouldn't that be great? Mm-hmm. And there are people who can do it. There are people who can are predisposed to being able to sort of know they're in a dream and be able to kind of do whatever they want in that dream. It's, you know, sometimes it could be anything from, we call it, you know, in the book it's called the Superman experience, where you're flying. I remember as a kid having a dream where, you know, that those dreams where you're actually flying over somewhere, it's an incredible experience. And then some of the dreams, of course, are sexual in nature. So it was a combination of some of those things. I tried to actually limit the number of dream descriptions because it often can stop the action. And I tried to tie them into whatever the action was. It can get boring to kind of have people describing their dreams and this and that. So I tried to keep them the minimum. And in the end, the publisher actually wanted me to put a few more in along the way. So I ended up putting a few more. Fremer has a dream when he's in the hospital that was inserted. And then Madden has one when he's on the plane coming back from New York that I put in after the first draft.
All I know is that some of those dreams, you felt like you were right there. And the way you described them, you felt like, oh my God, he's having a good time in this one, and that's interesting in that one. And then you wake up and you realize that it was a dream. It's amazing, and you never know. So, as he investigates more about this, he learns about someone by the name of Kathleen, and things take on a different turn. Why is she not eager to talk to Fremer, and why does she keep his phone? You know, why does he keep his phone on when he's interviewing people? Which is quite clever, in a sense, to protect yourself.
Well, that's Madden, actually. He goes to see the woman out in the daughter of Stacy and Ross, who she's to let people know, basically, both the crime in California, the cold case. What happens is that the wife disappears, and then the husband is accused of it, but they have trouble. They can't, without a body, and they have some evidence, but not enough to essentially bring him to trial and get a conviction. So for a few years, initially the husband is suspected, but still there, and then he ends up disappearing himself. They think he's gone to he's gone to Vietnam, and so he's hanging. They think he's hanging out in Vietnam, and so you have two. You have the wife disappeared, the husband disappears, and then the daughter is left. And so the daughter in the book is now, I think she's 26. She was a young girl when maybe she's 20. Maybe she's a little bit older than that. She's like around 20, 29. In the book, she was about 9 when her parents ended up disappearing. And so Madden goes to talk to her to see what she remembers from the case. And they think the father has been in contact, even though he's gone to Vietnam, he's been in contact with the family. And what happened in the real life case was this guy Moro had gone to the Philippines, and the police started staking out the family on holidays. And so in the real life case, the detective would spend his Thanksgiving, Christmas, staking out the relatives. He missed a lot of Thanksgivings and Christmases to stake out the relatives. So that was how the real case and the fictional version are related.
That's interesting. That's really interesting. So, who is Isabella, and AKA Rachel, and why does she wind up in the hospital, and what happens that alerts readers that someone wants to kill her too? They don't want her to speak out either. So what does she have to do with this?
She's actually not. She doesn't end up in the hospital. Tremor. She works at the lucid dreaming center. She works with this guy, Braden. And so she had, she's trying to get, she picks up Fremmer, and she's a very attractive young woman. And so Fremmer ends up going with her up to the lucid dreaming center, and they want money from him. And then she agrees to have a drink with Fremmer, and then she slips him a GHB, a day rape drug, and he ends. The next thing he knows, he wakes up in the hospital. So again, I'm not going to give away too many spoilers, but she's basically working for this guy at the Lucid Dreaming Center, and they're trying to get money from Fremmer, money back from Fremmer, that is supposedly the advance that they gave Candace, the woman who's pushed in front of the car. They supposedly gave her this money to write for them. So it's a little more complicated than that, but when I'm writing, I try to give everybody a motivation, obviously, for doing the things they're doing and threatening the people they're threatening. And also, obviously, you need a motive for people pushing people in front of cars and trying to murder people. So that's kind of all explained at the end, what's motivating these people. But while you're reading, I would say that you're not quite sure sometimes what is motivating these people and whether they're good guys or bad guys.
When these people go to the Lucid Dream Center, they have to pay to go there? Do they have to pay a fee to go there?
If they want to take classes, if they want to, some, you know, it's in a brownstone. It's actually on the Upper West Side of New York, not the Upper East Side. But they, people will come from around the world. They spend a few days there. They actually can sleep there, and they do, you know, they sleep and try to have lucid dreams, and they have seminars. And so the place is designed to be a money making venture, like a lot of these things are. And you don't know whether it's a scam or if it's real. And that's, I think, the case with a lot of these things that, whether it's any sort of spiritual, a lot of these spiritual things, a lot of these, it's unclear whether there's some good aspects to it, and there's also some potential room for preying on people's, a charlatan aspect to it, where they're taking money from people to for their own, for them to profit. So that's kind of the nefarious side to the.
That's what I would think. How dangerous is it to have these lucid dreams? Can they actually control it where you do something wrong, or you get up and you don't remember what happened and you wind up doing something wrong? Or they give people drugs during these dreams?
No, but they would try to. In the book, they're actually trying to develop something similar along the lines of what I was talking about, where you can. You wear this sort of halo thing on your head to stimulate your brain waves in a certain way. They were trying to develop that product to sell to people to try to stimulate lucid dreams. So that's there. There's supplements out there, meaning vitamins. If you look on Amazon, you can see that people are selling stuff that this and this. You know, vitamin is supposed to enhance lucid dreaming. I would say that's very questionable. But there are ways that you're supposed to try to trigger lucid dreaming. And I wouldn't say it's dangerous. It's just the idea. It's actually not so easy to learn how to have lucid dreams all the time. Because for a lot of people, again, they happen by chance, but there's certain ways to kind of set markers in your brain. The idea, of course, is while you're dreaming, that you have to realize you're dreaming. So by telling yourself certain things before you go to sleep, there's even apps out there on the App Store for lucid dreaming. So there's a lot of people, because it's very powerful to be able to essentially be in a world where it appears very real, but you can do whatever you want in it. And that, to me, is, it's a very powerful thing, and a lot of people are trying to achieve that.
Yeah, that is scary, because I wonder sometimes if somebody wakes up from one of these dreams and doesn't realize it's just a dream, and they go about and actually reenact what happened in that dream. That would be really scary and kind of dangerous, yeah. So when you came up with the chapter headings, how did you come up with the chapter headings for each of the different chapters to let, readers know what was going to happen? Because they're interesting.
Yeah, I've done that since the first book, and I just kind of, it's almost sort of like a headline for the chapter to sort of just draw people in. And I try to take the most interesting phrase or interesting part of the chapter and make that the chapter head and grab people.
Yeah, I did, especially when number 31 says dumb luck, which is interesting. And then we have the oracle and then a view to kill. So you never know what's going to happen. It's interesting that. And then, of course, 14 postcards. That was really, it's just sort of like you never know what you can expect in the chapter. So explain how the case of Stacy being missing connects to Candace.
well, without giving away any spoilers, I think the idea was to set up the cold case on the West Coast, and that so one chapter is California, the next chapter is New York, back and forth, and the reader kind of assumes that they're related, if there's some connection, but the idea was to not reveal the connection right away and let them, you know, it's revealed, I guess, about halfway through the book, a little more than halfway through the book, how the two cases are connected. And then that's when things kind of take off. And everyone's, you know, one of the parts that I'm, you know, most proud of is that a lot of people are wondering how the two cases connected, and they can't quite figure out what's going on. Some people who read, some of the readers who read mysteries are like, oh, I figured this out right away. And it's very difficult to create surprise endings and twists and turns and, create a puzzle for people to try to get through. So that's what I was trying to do. And for the most part, I haven't had someone say, like, I guessed this right away. So that's always a good thing.
It was interesting. Before I forget, this Thursday, hopefully, The Cat in the Flock will be at 10 a.m. And next Tuesday, internationally famous author Alan Jacobson, the Karen Vale series, The Darkness of Evil, special time, 1 p.m., because he's in California and he doesn't feel like getting up at 6 in the morning, I guess, to do a show. On the 8th, the next day, Mark Shaft, Force 10, Double a Penny. And on the 14th, New York Times author Terry James will be here with the first book of the Sam Craddock series. And on the 16th, the author of The Stolen. And on the 21st, Anthony Franz will be here with The Outsider. And I'm very excited about March 23rd. Tim Patton finally wrote the book in his own name, Kill Play. It's about the roller derby and what happens when AIDS hits the players and what happens when gay players are stricken with this particular horrible illness and what happened from the beginning. This is a true story that really happened to the author. So that's just some, and then we have A Tone for the Ivory Cloud to end off on the 30th, and after that, you just don't know. The show is booked till the end of June, they tell me. So this should be coming up, but Lucidity really got me because I never know what Partners in Crime is going to send me, and they just sort of send me everything, which is great. So why did Kevin Spacey come into this particular one, the actor Kevin Spacey? How did Frame Ring Contact Madden, and why Kevin Spacey? How did that come into it, which I thought was clever?
You know, it's funny because I think a few years back, there's some blog that says, that asked me to write, like, what, you know, if your characters were going to be in a movie, who would play your characters? So I think at that time, I said Kevin Spacey would play Madden. And so in this book, he's asked by some movie people to develop, a book based on his experiences. Kevin Spacey is interested in the project. And so because of that, he's a Hollywood, again, just for people new to the series, he's already gone through two murder cases. And so Hollywood was he's been in People magazine, and so Hollywood was interested in the story, but in kind of Hollywood fashion, there's that initial moment where they're interested and people are interested, and then the interest kind of passes and goes away. And so he got a lot of publicity at first, but then the project kind of peters out, and then he's trying to write this book based on that project. So that's how the Kevin Spacey, it would be nice if I think Kevin Spacey would be good as Hank Madden. So I would have other actors in mind for some of the I think Ryan Gosling would be pretty good as Max Bremer.
That's interesting. So if you were concerned about your dreams or whatever, or wanted to know, why would you go to the Lucidity Center? What would be their impetus to go there to start with? Especially if they didn't know what it was.
I think that anybody who's sort of experienced a lucid dream and can't quite, every once in a while, maybe it's, three times a year has a lucid dream. It's someone who really, got a charge of having that lucid dream, being able to, wake up in your dream and be able to control it,
mm-hmm.
have that, to be able to then say to yourself, okay, I want to be able to do this, once a week or almost every, some people can do it sort of at will. And so for someone who's interested in that aspect, would then try to go, would then go to the Lucid Dreaming Center and try to, learn how to have lucid dreams and learn how to, because there are some techniques to doing it. You can read about them online and do it that way, which a lot of people do, and there's a lot of forums out there and message boards to talk about it, whether it's on Reddit or wherever, and which I of course looked into. But then if you want to take the next step and actually go and sleep somewhere and be around other people trying to do this as well and have actual people who are well versed, and one of the guys is a professor at Columbia, and there's some there's a lot of legitimacy to this Lucid Treatment Center, but there's also the side that says, well, maybe these people are trying to make a buck at it too.
So who is, I'm looking at the book, I have it in front of me, and Framer decided, who is Chu, and what part does he play, and why does he ask if he can record the conversation?
Detective Chu is one of the police officers in New York City investigating the can that's being pushed in front of the car. So he's kind of, he initially asked Fremmer to come to the police station, and later he's basically Fremmer's contact in New York City police, who he later ends up hooking up with. But he's basically the one who's one of the detectives who's investigating Candace being pushed in front of his car. So that's his relation to the story.
No, that's interesting. So we've got Marcus, who's kind of dangerous. We've got Braden, who's kind of dangerous. So we have Rochelle Isabel, and she has a way of infiltrating the center. So who is Xander, and what part do they play together, these two?
He is another guy that he's hooked up with Rochelle and Isabel. She has two names. So she's part of his past. And then you learn more about him towards the end of the book. Again, not giving away any spoilers, but they're mm-hmm. they're kind of hooked up. They've been hooked up together. It's funny because the Rochelle character was based on a real life thing where I used to have a big fish tank, and I had to in my New York City apartment, we had to rip up the floors because of a problem with the initial installation. It was a new building, so we're going to get new floors. I had this big fish tank. And so I decided that I was going to get rid of my big fish tank. So I paid someone to come and take away the fish and donate them to the store. And they're not allowed to there are not a lot of aquarium stores that have had my kind of fish. I had these African cichlids from Lake Tanganyika. And so there was a store down on Delancey Street, and they sent, I went down there, and they said, yeah, we can send someone up. So I paid. So someone came and dismantled my fish tank. And this woman, this very pretty woman, came and took my fish away. So she became, in the story, Rochelle, that is one of her previous jobs, is cleaning fish tanks. And she cleaned, at the Lucid Dreaming Center, they have a big fish tank when you first come in. And so that's how, that was her entree into the Lucid Dreaming Center. She cleaned this guy Braden's fish tank. So that's so a little slice of real life went into the novel.
So when the reader learns more about Ross and Stacy and their relationship, it comes to mind that there is a hidden secret that hasn't been brought out. So what happens when Madden learns the truth, and why won't he tell that to the detective? And why does the detective keep bringing him in every 10 minutes?
Are you talking about Fremmer coming in? Yeah, Fremmer. On one coast, Fremmer discovers something, and then he's the one. I'm trying not to give any spoilers away, so
yeah.
So that, you know, that's how the two cases end up connecting. But they're, you know, the detectives in New York City they're trying to solve the case of who pushed. They have this homeless guy who they think her in front of the car, but they don't know whether someone paid him to do it. So they're trying to figure out, and a lot of the times, you know, the police will bring someone in and start asking them questions just to see what they're going to say. And they try to, sometimes the police lie and ask, say they have more information than they do, or they're, you know, and so that's part of the, what they're doing with Fremmer anyway.
So who is this oracle? Tell us about Ron Derby and what he meant when he refers to the oracle when questioning and talking to Fremmer. Why did they think he had something to do with it?
Yeah, so the Ronald Darby is the homeless guy that's called in. And so the way he talks, it's unclear whether he himself is he's crazy, whether he's not crazy. Fremmer actually comes to believe that he's not guilty, that he didn't push Candace in front of the car. So he actually helps lead his defense. But he just has this feeling that it just doesn't seem right. There's more to the story. And so Ronald Darby talks about this oracle who told him that he was going to be famous. And so that's kind of the first hint of something's amiss, that there's this phantom. You don't know whether, again, it's whether Darby is a little bit crazy it's been having visions, and, you know, is the oracle real? Is the oracle not real? So that's... Mm. He says the oracle took his picture and said he was going to be famous. So later on, you find out what that's all about.
Well, a lot of times people assume that homeless people are crazy, but they're really not. So it sort of, you know, made sense. So who is Denise? And tell us about her relationship with Fremmer's son. Why does he prefer to talk to her than his own father?
So Fremmer, his backstory is that he had a fiance, and they were together in Mexico, and she ends up body surfing in a wave and ends up breaking her neck and becoming paralyzed below her waist. and they end up not getting married, and he ends up leaving. And Tremor's actually written he himself has written a book about his experience with his. As I said, everyone in the book has written a book, including Tremor, which is why he's sort of, it gives him some people. When you're a book doctor, it helps to have actually written a book yourself, because then people know you've have some skill at it. And so that was his book. It was sort of his own story about that happened about 10 years earlier, and it's always kind of haunted him that he ended up breaking up with his fiance because that she's paralyzed. And so he's very torn about that. And during the period of while he's kind of anguished about this years earlier, he is a little bit of a drinking problem, ends up hooking up with a one night stand, and ends up having a kid with the one night stand, who then he ends up with the kid. So he's a single father, and it turns out later that he still has his son has actually been talking with his ex-fiancee Denise, who the woman who's been paralyzed.
She's a good character, though. I liked her, even though she wasn't there for a very long time. I liked her.
Ironically, I will tell you a story. The editor actually wanted me to cut her out of the book.
Mm.
And I decided not to. I said, I actually wanted to enhance her. I'd rather enhance her a bit than cut her. I felt she was integral to the story and integral to Fremmer's backstory. So, and I liked her. So I enhanced her a bit.
No, I liked her, and I sort of made Fremmer a little bit more human, and it sort of showed a different side of him, and I liked her too. And the fact that his son really cared about her, even though she was disabled, made it even better. And
yeah.
A lot of people don't understand that disabled people can still have a useful life too. They don't realize that. So, we have about 10 more minutes, not even. When creating this novel, how did you come up with the cover? That cover is interesting.
You know, I didn't, since these are not self-published books, I had no control of the cover. But ironically, my first two books, I'm with a smaller publisher, Overlooked is one. It's actually one of the biggest independent publishers still upstanding, but it is a small publisher. And for the first two books, when I first saw the covers, I asked them to change them. And so when you go with a smaller publisher, you do have a little bit more control than you have if I was with Simon & Schuster or someone like that, where you get what you get and you don't get upset. But what happened was, this was the first cover. I feel like I kind of trained them that they showed me the cover, and it was the first one that I was like, wow, that's good. And so the first two also have women on the cover. The knife music it's interesting because it's actually a woman. You can't tell, but it's a woman underwater. And it was a photographer in Germany. It was kind of a stock photo they bought, but she takes her own photos of herself underwater. The second one was a stock photo as well that I found online and gave to the publisher. This one, I assume, was a stock photo that they found themselves, and I was totally happy with the cover from the get-go. I didn't know about the title because that was my just a stand-in title. There's some other books out there called Lucidity. There's a perfume called Lucidity, and I wasn't at all sure about the title. I thought it fit the book, but at the same time, I like doing unique titles. I like the idea of having a one-word title. I don't like long titles. I've done the first two books were two words, one word. The publisher really liked it, and claim that, you know, when your book comes out on Amazon, they bump up that title to the top of the search. So that was my main issue was I wasn't sure whether it was the best title for the book, but when the publisher likes it, you just go with it.
Well, it fits because lucidity, well, lucid means clear. And
yep.
Lucid Dream, yeah, and Lucidity Fit. I don't think anything else would have fit as the title of the book. And that's got me because I did some research before I wrote your review, which is going to come out later. Yeah. And I wanted to make sure that, yeah, I do that. When I want to make sure that I'm right about something or I get what the title is about, because I got this right away, I go like, wait a minute. Yeah, last night I got up in the middle of the night and I'm saying like, what just happened? Did that really happen to me? Yeah. So in case anybody thinks that this isn't reality, it is. It's your own virtual reality sometimes. So where do you see Madden and where do you see Fremma? Are you going to bring them back? And when you created this novel, did you create Fremma's first role and then Madden second, or did you just connect them together?
I connected them. The publisher likes when you have characters continue on, particularly the detective. So it's a series.
Mm-hmm.
If someone likes one, they tend to buy the others. So they like it when they have, but they're designed to be standalone novels. And, they want me to do something that's actually based, once again on a kind of a real life, whether it's a murder or whatever. So, it's harder and harder to get publicity for books, and reviews and all that stuff. So it helps when it's based on something that's happened. So, I have an idea and I've been working on it, Madden will most likely come back. In some cases, I'll bring back characters as more minor characters. A number of characters were bigger characters in my previous books that had kind of appeared in Lucidity. So it's possible I would say that as much as I like Fremmer, I'm not sure he'll be the main character in the next one. So... it'll probably be a totally new creation.
Oh, good. And when is the next one coming out? And when does Fran get it?
I don't know, but I have to write quicker. Problem is I have my day job and four kids. People want me to write faster. But I'm probably looking at a couple of years. I tend to take a little bit more time than some of the people who churn out, one novel a year. If you're a mystery thriller writer, that should be the pace you're on, is one novel a year. I don't have a, $20 million contract to incentivize me to do that. I hope to write this one faster. I do have a due date later this year, but that'll probably get pushed.
So where can everybody, before we end, find out about you and your work and Lucid Dreams? It's really good.
You can certainly, the book is basically everywhere. It's in stores, it's online. I'm on Goodreads, obviously. And, it's actually a very good price on the digital version on Amazon right now. It lists for $7.99, but they're selling it for $6.15. On Amazon, and it got a mention in Time magazine last week, so it's doing pretty well. And I have a website, davidcarnoy.com, C-A-R-N-O-Y. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter, David Carnoy, at David Carnoy. So I'm pretty easy to find, especially in Google. And if you want to, contact me. I've had people actually contacting me lately from Australia for some reason, and they can't buy a book in Australia. They can't buy the book in Australia, so I've actually sent a few digital copies, uncopied protected digital copies to Australia. Occasionally I will send out free books to people digitally if they are really nice to me and have trouble getting the book, because I want people to read the book. I don't really care that much about making money on it.
Well, I have to tell everybody that, you know, lucidity is great, and my review is going to come out this afternoon, definitely, with 10 stars at least, seriously. It's so great because I haven't been giving 5 stars to anybody lately. And I would like to tell everybody that I'm excited. My magazine, MJ9, which is for readers, writers, authors, anyone that wants to write an article, speak out, book reviews, writing tips, publishing tips, anything, MJ9 came out last week. And I am so excited because it's got a couple of 5-star reviews. MJ was my sister who died, Marcia Joyce, who encouraged me to become a book reviewer. It's a whole story. She dared me, and I just did it. And when my mom was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, I had to retire from teaching because I was a reading specialist in writing, and I decided to create this network, which is MJ Network in her memory. And MJ9 is out on Amazon, and it's got a whole bunch of book reviews. It's got a whole bunch of short stories. It's got poems. It's got everything in it and writing tips. So if anyone out there wants to write an article for MJ10, MJ10 should be out, I hope, in May or June, we're hoping. And if you want to write something on lucid dreams, that would be great, too, because I think people need to read different things in the magazine.
All right. Great.
I want to thank you so very much. This has been great. This part of my day is going to be fantastic. Unfortunately, the rest of it, well, we're not going to even talk about that. That's not going to be any fun, but we shall survive, I hope. They told me that when you lose a tooth, you're supposed to get money. So I'm going to make sure that I get some this afternoon. Because what's the point of
a wisdom tooth and you lose your wisdom?
It's not. Thank God it's not a wisdom tooth, because otherwise I would be lacking more wisdom. No, it's a molar, and it decided that it hates me. So I told my husband that if I don't get money for the tooth, at least, you know, $10 a person, then I'm going to go out and buy an outfit for every day I don't get money. Seriously. Because, you know, I'm so brave. But thank you so very much. Everybody have a great day. It's beautiful outside. The sun is shining. It's gorgeous. It's only like 40 degrees. It's New York City, Upper Westchester, and have a great day. And David, thank you so much. And when you write the next one, please make sure I get it.
Okay, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Take care.